You're listening to Wheelationships.
Anyway, we have been discussing apologies, why we do them, who they benefit, what's the purpose, and we began last week detailing the five different languages of apology. And as we've said, not all five are necessary in every apology. It depends on the situation. But of the five languages, one or two is going to speak sincerity more than to your particular heart than the others will. And last week we talked about language number one, which is expressing regret. You have on your handout there a few review points we're going to hit real quickly this morning, just to catch you up and refresh you where we have been. The two most important words in an apology, of course, are I'm sorry or I apologize, and we discussed how they came from different roots. They were not always as synonymous as we use them today. They were not interchangeable. Sorry has also been shown to be a more powerful expression than I apologize. I'm sorry has more power than I apologize. And when you express regret, you're focusing on what you did or didn't do and how it affects the other person. That's the regret. We also talked about how your body language needs to agree with the words that you're saying in order for the apology to ring sincere into the ears of the listener. We talked about the importance of being specific. It's not just enough to say you're a jerk. You need to specify exactly how you were a jerk so that they can clearly see you understand what the offense was. Again, because that places the focus on the action. Good relationships grow when we express regret for hurt. That's where I was going. For hurts that were unintentional. It expresses empathy for the hurt. We talked about men's brains and women's brains. If you remember our friend Mark Gungor, I read an article from his website, how our brains were created so differently. They function so differently from one another. Man's has individual boxes. Woman's is all wired and interconnected. And because of that completely different creativity, they're going to process an apology completely different. Men can open that apology box, deal with the issue, close it, and move on. A woman, not so much. She needs time to process, and a husband needs to allow his wife that time to process the offense, the hurt, the apology, and everything that goes with it, and everything that she connected it to during that process in order for her to be able to move on. And you need to allow her that time to process without any kind of rebuke. And I want to drag in one more little example into the regret section. A portion that I was reading this past week that reminded me a little bit of the question that Tony brought forth last week. And in essence, what he was saying was, what if someone is hurt by something we've done, but what we did was necessary? The hurt was there, but it was necessary for what we did. Now, we did address that sometimes it's not what we do, but how we do it. Sometimes you need to apologize and express regret for maybe the poor way in which you communicated it. You were harsh or unkind or what have you. But sometimes that regret involves an action that we would nevertheless repeat. It was a necessary action. One of the books we've been using, I told you about, is John Cater, Effective Apology. I'm going to read you a little example that he brings out in his book here that I thought was illustrated this nicely. Jack Welch, a former CEO of General Electric, described an incident in his book, Winning, and that's where this example comes from. He recounts the experience of a manager of a 60-person unit of a fast-growing company. This executive was approached by an 8-year veteran of her team, call her Cynthia, who requested permission to work at home on Fridays in an effort to better balance her professional and her parental responsibilities. Cynthia had just delivered her second child. A working mother herself, the executive gave her approval because she had confidence that Cynthia, a superstar with the company, would continue to deliver stellar results. Well, when word got around that one employee was allowed to work from home on Fridays, the executive was then approached by another employee named Carl. Carl requested a similar dispensation. Carl had been with the company for less than a year. He had not distinguished himself, and he explained that he wanted Fridays off in an effort to better balance his responsibilities to his career and his yoga practice. The executive denied Carl's request. Carl objected that the executive was discriminating against him. These was what Carl's words and thoughts were. You're imposing your values on me. You're saying that mothering has more value than yoga. I'm never going to have children. Who are you to say that my yoga is less meaningful in my life than Cynthia's children are in her life? So he goes on to say a lot of the dialogue wasn't recorded there. You know, the executive could have very well gotten, you know, defensive or gotten confrontational, that Carl would even suggest that he was being discriminatory. But when pushed, the executive responded, "I'm sorry, that's the decision I've made." And that was it. But what happened was, all throughout the week, the rest of the people within the company started all these little mini debates about the issue, and everybody was getting sucked into the problem and trying to discuss over the fairness and values, and these mini debates went on, and the executive began to regret that she had not been more direct in her response. First off, let me say the "sorry" used in the context that she said, "I'm sorry, that's just a decision I made." That's not really an apology at all, by the way. So he goes on to say, let's imagine that this was the response from the executive. It would have been more effective. "Carl, I'm sorry I got angry with you. I regret that I participated in a debate over the merits of parenting and yoga. Those issues are irrelevant to my decision to deny your request at work at homes on Fridays. The fact is, I made my decision on the basis of your work results. Frankly, you haven't earned the privilege of working at home on Fridays because you haven't demonstrated you can do the job Monday through Thursday. I'm happy to have a conversation with you about your results to date. My decision stands." That's an apology that is clear in its regrets, being sucked into the debate, while still reaffirming the decision itself and saying why it was a good decision. See, the executive would have done Carl no favors to give him a false sense of what their standing is with the company. To try to flatter. It was clear, it was direct. Good purpose and good point. Carl might have been hurt. It might have hurt his feelings. He might have been upset by that. But as we've mentioned before in a class, and this is what I was groping to try to find when Tony was asking that, and I couldn't come up with it, there is a difference between hurt and harm. We're going to revisit Dr. Cloud, our boundary guy. Tim spoke on this before. It's a very, very short clip on the difference between hurt and harm.
Basically, this says that we have to know the difference between hurt versus harm. Hurt versus harm. I was talking to a man one day on a consulting project, and I said, "Well, he was talking about a VP of his that was not doing his job." And I said, "Well, you know, you just have to cut back on his responsibilities." He said, "I can't do that." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because that would hurt him." I said, "Well, of course it would hurt him, but you got to do it." I said, "If you don't, you're going to lose the company." He said, "But I can't do that. He said, my friend, I can't hurt him that way." I said, "You know what, it's not going to harm you. It's going to hurt. The wounds of a friend are better than the kisses of an enemy." Sometimes things can actually hurt and be good for us. I asked him, I said, "You ever been in the dentist?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Did it hurt?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Did it help you?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Did eating all that sugar hurt?" "No." "Did it harm you?" "Yes." See, here's the law. Just because somebody's screaming doesn't mean something bad is happening. You get that? Just because somebody's screaming doesn't mean something bad is happening. There's a verse in the Bible that says all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. And in the end, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
Got that? The difference between hurt and harm. There may be regret for hurt you've caused. That may happen. There may be regret for harm that you have done. But there may also be regret while still reaffirming the decision that you made. Now, before I move from regret onto language number two, I'm going to digress a moment with an example that Kitty gave us last week. And she was sharing with us a psychologist from her school and their opinion on this whole subject of apologies, "I'm sorry," or versus "I apologize." And what they were asking the teachers there to do was to say "I'm sorry" rather than "I apologize," and that being that it might make the child feel bad, or they might feel badly about themselves, or that they're a bad person, and the implication there is that it would be harmful to the child's self-esteem. And I want to elaborate on that just a little bit because I have just pondered that all week long. First, I really would like to praise Kitty because obviously she's in a position where she's not doing a job. You could tell by the way she's sharing her heart. She cares. She's in a position where she's really ministering, and I think that's wonderful. And she cares about the leadership over her. But what the school psychologist is encouraging is not new. And I want to take just a minute to digress just a bit, because there are lots of you that are still raising kids in here. And if you're not, you have influence over your grandchildren. And I think this is a really important issue to address. I'm going to do that for just a minute. But I had some articles that I saved from a couple years ago that spoke on this. I drug them out and went online and was doing lots of research on this week and came across lots of studies that show both secular and Christian perspectives from psychologists, from universities, all shedding light on this. And some of them, especially in the last couple of years, are doing a whole turnabout on this whole self-esteem campaign that our country has been bombarding us with here lately. One of them was, and I'll probably butcher his name, Roy Baumeister from Florida State University, did extensive study. And yes, good things can come from FSU. showing, and this is what he and his team had come to prove over lots of studies, high self-esteem is closely associated with antisocial inclinations, among a lot of other negative ramifications. This is from the Washington Times, and those of you that have heard of John Roseman, a family psychologist. I've got the whole article if you want to read it, but I'm just, for time's sake, going to hit some highlights here. In the 1960s, American parents stopped going to their elders for advice and began going instead to mental health professionals, people like me, he says. To create a devoted client base, we had to come up with something new. So we cut from a whole cloth a philosophy that was 180 degrees removed from the philosophy that had successfully guided every previous generation of parents. The centerpiece of this new point of view was the notion that high self-esteem is a good thing, and parents should do all in their power to make sure their children acquire it. Mind you, we made this up. Absolutely no empirical evidence obtained by scientific means exists to support this claim. It just sounded good, therefore it was very easy to market. High self-esteem is the card that supports the house of cards. That is what I call postmodern psychological parenting. Pull that card and the whole stack falls. He goes on later to say, people with high self-regard, this is where I'm picking up on some of your notes there on your paper. People with high self-regard, the evidence says, possess low regard for others. Instead of seeking opportunities to serve others, they seek to manipulate others. Furthermore, people with high self-regard tend to antisocial behavior. People incarcerated in maximum security prisons, for example, have a very high self-regard. Pre-psychological parenting emphasized respect for others. With people with high other regard seek opportunities to serve. Therefore, they pay attention to other people. People with high self-esteem want to be served and to be paid attention to. It's the simple difference between wanting to do for others and wanting others to do for you. Obligation versus entitlement. So the question is it possible for a child to have high self-esteem and a high level of respect for others? The answer is an unequivocal no. It goes on to say one of the biggest complaints he gets from parents in particular is this comment, but I want my child to be confident. There is no evidence that people who are humble, modest, and possess high regard for others lack the belief that they're capable of dealing with life's challenges. And he goes on to give several examples. And near the bottom it says, self-esteem doesn't pass the common sense test either. Would you rather be employed by, work alongside, be close friends with, or be married to a person with high self-esteem or a person who is humble and modest? And then this was from Margaret Schneider, who's a professor at Eastern Pennsylvania College. She says, when American students are compared to students of other countries, the only category in which they come out on top is self-esteem. In other words, they don't know nearly as much as they think they do. If you went to school more than 25 or 30 years ago, you probably never heard of self-esteem at the time. Nobody was worried about your self-esteem. They were too worried and busy about educating you. In the process, they, along with your parents, were teaching you self-respect. Big difference. Before you learned to respect yourself, even before you learned to read, you had already learned to respect others, especially those older than you, such as your parents, their friends, and your teachers. Having learned respect, you were able to have respect for yourself as well. you could respect yourself because you had been taught certain behaviors that are worthy of respect, such as kindness, honesty, a sense of duty, or faithfulness, and following rules. Children raised to feel good about themselves just because, or even just because God made them, tend to continue to regard themselves as the center of the universe and do special treatment whenever they feel like it, because after all, they are so special. Somehow, the idea that everyone else is just special and that God made them too never seems to be part of the message. And it reminded me of that silly little children's fable, The Emperor's New Clothes, where the king's running through the streets buck naked and nobody has the guts to tell him because they don't want to mess up the whole apple cart. And we have become a society that is so stinking hypersensitive that they're just so afraid they got to speak the exact politically correct language so that nobody will be offended or feel badly about themselves or feel bad about their behavior. And I pondered all this, I thought of King David. It may seem like a weird stretch to you, but that's where my mind went. And there's one thing that secular history and biblical history agree on, and that is that King David was a mighty leader. He was an amazing king. Even people that don't believe scripture will get behind that notion. He was mighty. God placed David over his own anointed people to be the leader of his chosen people. And he cherished that leadership so much, he promised to continue a lineage of David forever and ever. And as you read the Psalms, you find David pouring out his heart. And you look at the Psalms and you see David was never afraid to be brutally honest about himself. In scripture, you find David comparing himself to a worm, the lowliest of creatures. A worm, this mighty king, nothing but a worm. But you see that David was not without his faults as well, as of course you know this. As far as commandments go, he pretty much trampled all over them. He lusted after another man's wife. He had sex outside of marriage with her. He got her pregnant. He had her husband murdered. And then he tried to cover everything up and tried to hide it all. But even, this is what amazes me, even after having done all of that, he still referred to as the apple of God's eye. God still refers to him as a man after God's own heart. Why? Because David understood what we're talking about right now, and David knew how important it was to say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." And when the prophet Nathan confronted David with his atrocious sin, David didn't pull out any excuses. He didn't place any blame. He didn't try to find some nice label that he could put on it so it wouldn't make him feel so bad. Because that's what we do. We relabel everybody so they don't have to feel bad about themselves. And if you look at Psalms chapter 51, that is a really neat psalm. Because that is the psalm that David wrote after he was confronted by Nathan. And we're privileged to get just a little glimpse of what was going on in the heart of David after the sin was brought to light before Nathan and the prophet. And here's a couple of verses I want to show you. Verse 3, "For I recognize my shameful deeds. They haunt me day and night. Against you and you alone I have sinned. I have done what is evil in your sight." Verses 5 and 6, "I was born a sinner. Yes, from the moment my mother conceived me. But you desire honesty from the heart." Why? Why? "So you can teach me to be wise in my inmost being." Verses 16 and 17, "You will not be pleased with sacrifices, or I'd bring them. If I brought you burnt offerings, you would not accept it." The sacrifice you want, what, high self-esteem? No. The sacrifice God wants is a broken spirit. A broken and repentant heart, O God, you will not despise. You know, we're going to talk about repentance here in another week or two. But I want you to hear the cry of David's heart in this psalm. He wasn't concerned about his self-esteem. He was hungry for humility. He wasn't worried about somebody putting a politically incorrect label on him, or God forbid he should feel bad about himself. No, his heart cried out, "I'm sorry. I have sinned. I was wrong." And that's what my heart should cry out in the face of my sin and my wrongdoing. It's why your heart should be crying out. So, there I go. But now we're going to go on to language number two. I feel better.
I think you should give that one for the fall victory.
Just did.
Language number two ties into that. Accepting responsibility, which says, I was wrong. Now, I briefly began that last week when we ran out of time. I'll refresh your memory. I read three examples, three different people who... there was the employer who spoke very harshly to his employee, although felt it was necessary. The woman who was chronically late, and the boy who, having surgery under medication, was rude and swatted at his mom. All three of those were people who had excuses for their behavior, and because they had what they thought was a good reason or good excuse, they felt it negated any reason for them to need to apologize. Or sometimes we throw out that token apology that in no way accepts responsibility, but we hope nobody notices that. This was a comic that Tim found in the paper about a week or two ago, Pearls Before Swine. It says, I'm going to start apologizing to all the people I've insulted by telling them, I'm sorry that you were offended. Is that a real apology? No, and that's what's so great. It allows me to retain the impact of the original insult while tacking on the implied bonus insult of you're no oversensitive ninny. Well, that's kind of rude because it's saying the guy is too dumb to realize that. Oh, I'm sorry that you were offended. Apology accepted. An apology, a sincere apology, means that you're accepting responsibility for your actions. It acknowledges that what you did was wrong. It may not be what you did, but how you did it. Admitting wrong's hard for everybody. We showed you the little clip from Happy Days last week where Fonzie kind of comically can't get those words past his throat. You know, I was wrong. He can't get it there. And we may not stammer and stutter like Fonzie, but internally you've probably had that same struggle at one time or another. I know I have, where I didn't want to have to admit I was wrong. It can be difficult. And there's a lot of reasons why we resist apologizing. Week one, 2 weeks ago, we gave you a long list of some of those reasons. Sometimes it's that it's perceived as a weakness, and we don't want to feel weak. And Dr. Chapman, I'm running all these authors together, in the five languages of apology, he gave one of the examples. He says, for example, if you were a child overly punished, overly condemned, or shamed for minor offenses, your sense of worth is diminished. So admitting you're wrong puts you too close to those negative feelings from your childhood. So admitting that you're wrong becomes a very difficult thing for you to do. But the good news is we can learn from harmful patterns of our past and grow. We are all sinners. We are all going to do wrong. And the harmful messages of your past don't have to hold you captive in your present. When God comes on the scene and enters in your life, old things have passed away and all things have become new, and He creates in you something new. We grow up. We mature. The immature adult is forever rationalizing his bad behavior. And a lot of times we see that rationalization in the form of four little words. Any ideas what they are? It's not my fault. Although we do that one too, Ray, but it's not my fault. When we grow up, we may no longer use that childish phrase, but we're still communicating it by how we act, what we do, what we say, how we blame somebody else for our actions. We may be willing to admit that, yeah, what we did might not have been the best thing, but I was provoked by their unacceptable behavior, by their irresponsible behavior. I frequently have this dialogue with my kids, and I still have it with myself on occasion. You are not accountable or responsible for the attitudes or the actions of somebody else. You are only accountable for how you responded to their actions or responded to their attitudes. You see, we can never... Well, let me back up just a minute because I'm about to jump too far ahead of myself. I think I missed a blank.
No, you didn't.
Did I get it? Okay. No excuses, no blaming. You're responsible. And a major step towards becoming a mature adult is admitting mistakes. And for somebody whose primary love, whose primary apology language is this language number two, accepting responsibility, when they are listening to your apology, That's what they're listening for. They're waiting to hear the words, I was wrong, which, by the way, are a completely different meaning from I'm sorry. They're waiting to hear from you, I was wrong, or something similar that conveys that message. And without it, that apology does not feel sincere to them. Now, we can never know for certain if somebody is sincere when they apologize, because all we have to go on are the words they say and the intent. So that's why what you say is so important, or what you fail to say is so important. Now, Dr. Chapman gave a lot of really good examples in his book of married couples in particular that have been caught in this trap of failing to apologize, or using the excuse of their childhood, the way mom and dad did things. And so they're kind of copying that pattern in this marriage that they're having now, and it's causing damage in the relationship. But regardless of where you find yourself in relationship, regardless of the patterns of your past, maybe a parental example that was not a very healthy one, we have to push beyond our desire to blame and accept responsibility. And one of the examples that he concluded with, an approach that I really liked, and I put it there in your notes, is called the agree-disagree approach. And the intent here is to help you know how to think in a world that's full of human failure, because that's what we live in. And it says this: I agree that I have a right to feel hurt, angry, disappointed, and frustrated, or whatever else I may be feeling. I don't choose my feelings. I simply experience them. On the other hand, I disagree with the idea that because of my feelings, I have the right to hurt someone else with my words or behavior. Therefore, I will seek to express my emotions in a way that will not be hurtful, but will hold potential for reconciliation. That's what our thinking should be. But unfortunately, just because we have new plans doesn't mean old patterns immediately disappear. We're going to still make mistakes. I wish it were that simple, but it's not. But you understand, Christians sin, right? Christians are still capable of sinning. But when we sin, we must learn to confess our sin to both God and the person that we've sinned against. A couple verses for you there. 1 John 1:9. But if we confess our sins to him, he is faithful and just to forgive us and cleanse us from every wrong. James 5:16 says the earnest prayer of a righteous person has great power and wonderful results. Good relationships, healthy relationships, are not dependent upon perfection, thank goodness. Just a willingness to acknowledge our wrongs and seek forgiveness. Everyone makes mistakes. Allow the people that you're in relationship with the same grace that you desire in allowing them to make mistakes. The only mistakes that destroy a relationship are the ones that we're not willing to admit that we've made. Now, as we did in language one, I've provided for you there a few sample statements that express this second language, accepting responsibility. You don't have to use these exact words, but you understand it's the feel of the message that comes across there. I know that what I did wrong, I could try to excuse myself, but there is no excuse. Pure and simple, what I did was selfish and wrong. Or I made a big mistake. At the time, I didn't think much about what I was doing. But in retrospect, I guess that's the problem. I wish I had thought before I acted. What I did was wrong. The way I spoke to you was wrong. It was harsh and untrue. I spoke out of anger, trying to justify myself. The way I talked to you was unkind and unloving. I hope you will forgive me. And then the last one, I repeated a mistake that we've discussed before. I really messed up. I know that it was my fault. That's what someone whose apology language is accepting responsibility wants to hear. That's what their heart longs for, to be able to let go and to be able to really hear the message that that apology is sincere. Any comments, questions before we go? Anything we covered this morning? All right, come back next week. We've got 3 more languages to get to. You don't want to miss them. So thanks for coming. Appreciate you being here.